Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "A hero is no braver than an ordinary man, but he's brave 5 minutes longer." For Chesley Sully Sullenberger, it took less than 5 minutes to make him a hero. In a new book, the U.S. Airways pilot explains how his upbringing, years as a fighter pilot, and career prepared him for the day he was forced to land his airliner in the Hudson. He also talks about how becoming famous has affected his marriage and family. His new book is titled Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. And Captain Sully joins me in the studio this morning. Delighted to see you and have you here.
Diane, thank you for letting me be on your show.
You know, I think there are an awful lot of people out there who are going to want to talk with you. I'm going to invite their calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Don't forget, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. I see you have no uniform on today.
No, but I want the listeners to know that I really have lots of dark hair and I look a little bit like Brad Pitt. And that's the beauty of radio. The listeners can use their imagination.
It's the wonder of radio, and I've always adored it for that reason. I gather just recently, on October 1st, you flew the same route, that is, New York to Charlotte, as that fateful day in January. What did it feel like to be in the cockpit?
Well, of course, it's a very familiar place. It felt great. Not only to be back in the cockpit, to be reunited with my first officer from January 15th, Jeffrey Skiles. It was great to fly with him. And in addition to that, the air traffic controller, whose voice everyone hears on the radio recordings that have been played on the news many times, came into work early just so he could work our departure from New York, and I had a chance to once again report to him I was lifting off from LaGuardia, climbing to 5,000 feet, and he said, "It's good to hear your voice."
Oh, that's terrific. How old were you when you decided you wanted to be a pilot?
Oh, I was all of five.
Really?
I went through a brief phase, like most kids do, I think, when I was probably 4 and a half. I wanted to be a policeman for a while, and then what in those days was called a fireman. Now would be a firefighter. But by the time I was five, it was clear to me that I was going to spend my life flying airplanes.
Why do you think that was?
My father had always been fascinated by airplanes. Before World War II, when he graduated from dental school, he applied to be a naval aviator and had passed all the tests, had taken the physical exam and everything, but at the last minute decided that since he'd been trained to be a dentist, he probably would do the most good doing that. But we've always had airplane books and magazines around the house. I built model planes as a kid. It was just a passion I picked up somewhere along the way.
So you, in fact, went on to do what he didn't do.
Yes, that's correct.
What he wanted to do.
At least, you know, he loved dentistry. He loved the interaction with his patients. But obviously there was something else there, too, that he liked.
Dennis in Texas. Tell us about growing up there.
Oh, it was a wonderful place to grow up. It's not much bigger now than it was then. Probably population in the low 20,000s. North Texas, north of Dallas, right on the Red River. A big man-made lake there, Lake Texoma. And my parents actually lived about 10 miles outside of town on land that originally had been part of my maternal grandfather's dairy farm. And on a bluff overlooking the lake, beautiful views. Every summer we would go camping and water skiing and boating and just spend time at a sandy beach or two. So I have really fond memories of growing up there.
There's something in your book that you write about that really intrigued me because I remember the incident so vividly. And that was the night that Kitty Genovese was killed.
Yes.
You were 13 at
yes.
the time. Why did that have such an impact on you? and how?
I think it did, because for the first time I realized what was possible, what could happen in the world outside my little sphere of awareness in a rural town in North Texas in the early 1960s. In a big city, things could be different. And it was shocking to me that, according to the reports at the time at least, seemingly several dozen people heard or saw something going on and didn't choose to effectively intervene. That to me was inconceivable with my view of the world. Of course, I didn't have much perspective at age 13 in which to put this, but it really disturbed me. And I made a promise to myself that if I was ever in a situation where I could affect the outcome, I would choose to do so.
Did you talk to your friends about the incident? Did you talk to your parents?
I'm sure I would have talked to my parents about it, but yeah. This was more of an internal dialogue. Mm. I guess I would say that I've lived much of my life in kind of a thoughtful, considered way, and I think that's one of the reasons I was able to do what we had to do on January 15th and to deal with all this attention after the fact. I'm pretty sure about what I know, and I know there are some things I don't know, but I really try to figure things out and what makes sense to me, and I tried to be very good about choosing a good path in which to live my life, and this was certainly one of the seminal events that shaped me.
How has the attention on you affected you and your family?
Well, our lives changed in an instant, and not only for everyone on the airplane, but their families and many others too. One of the most amazing things about this is just the enormity of the story. And in the first few days, we didn't know all this. I wasn't watching any of the media. We were busily preparing for the interviews with the investigators. I was getting reports, though, about all the news coverage and how big a story this had become. The next surprise was how long this story has lasted. We expected that, as in most stories, the news cycle would be complete, people would move on and forget about it. And that simply just hasn't happened. So I think there was something special about this event, the way it happened, where it happened, and the time in the world's history in which it happened, that really made people feel a certain way, not only about the event, but about the crew and me. And part of the reason I wrote the book is because I wanted to answer a question for myself and for the readers. I think the reason this event has touched so many people is that it's life-affirming. It happened at a time when people were actively searching for good news. They wanted a reason to feel hopeful once again. They wanted to believe that people could be competent and could do the right thing. And I think that this event has reminded people around the world of the potential for good that exists not only in the world, but in each of us. So to answer your question more directly, at first this attention was so sudden it was overwhelming.
Yeah, I bet.
And then after a while it became surreal. In fact, surreal is the one word that my family and I have used in the early months after the January 15th emergency landing to describe not only the event, but the aftermath. It was hard to believe at some point that it really had happened. And after a few more months, we'd had time to think about it, to process it, to really incorporate it into our psyche and put it in perspective. Then we realized how special the outcome was and what a remarkable day we had.
It must have been really remarkable to, at some point, go to your front door and realize that all these independent and network television people were waiting out there, radio, everybody.
Well, at first, I wasn't seeing that. At first, I was still in New York, and I couldn't talk to the press because the investigators had asked me, had asked all of us not to. It was important to the integrity of the investigation that all the information about it come from official sources. And I, being a former accident investigator for the Pilots Association myself, I clearly understood the need for that. But my wife was at home alone initially trying to deal with this onslaught, and it was immediate. My name was released, or was discovered by the press, I'll say, very quickly after we landed, and the calls began immediately. We had people, my wife told me, we had people knocking on the door. There were a dozen satellite trucks in our street. Major news organizations were calling my kids' cell phones, trying to reach me. The fax machine was going off. Every line in the house was ringing. She had to have help, and she asked for help from her neighbors and friends, and one of the Pilots Association members who lives nearby came over and began helping with the situation. But we had to have a lot of help. It was just an amazing onslaught of attention because of this.
When you say overwhelming, it can really get to you.
Oh, I mean, 350, 400 media requests every day.
Wow.
For weeks. Mm-hmm. It finally subsided about 2 weeks later when we had that Danville welcome home ceremony. When I finally got back and the media had a chance to see me and hear me and they got some pictures, then it lessened somewhat. But until then, it was drinking from a fire hose, a very steep learning curve.
Did you feel in writing the book that you not only had a way to offer people some context as to who you were, but to sort of go over it in your own mind, to delve your own thinking about it?
Oh, absolutely. It was absolutely cathartic, and this was a real labor of love. Now, because it's such a personal book, it's a very personal book, I had a lot of material to use because I have a long life. Fortunately, this happened to me at a stage in my life when I was a mature adult, and I had the life experience to ultimately put this in perspective.
The book is titled Highest Duty, and Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger is here with me. We'll be right back. Captain Sullenberger, I want to go back to that very day because here's an email. This one from Bob, who says, "Good job. I'm a pilot, and I know what I would most fear in your place, my screwing up and not taking the right action. Now, tell me the truth," Bob goes on to say. "Did the thought cross your mind? Did you think, now, God, please don't let me screw this up?"
Well, that's one of my favorite lines from Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff. He's describing the very first American space launch with Alan Shepard. And in the movie, at least, and in the book, that's basically what he says. Of course, Commander Shepard had the great luxury of having time to think about it and have those words and actually say them, apparently. We didn't. We had 208 seconds from the time that we hit the birds until we landed in the Hudson River.
208 seconds.
Yes. And we were so busy. We had so much to do and so little time in which to do it. There was no time for extraneous thoughts.
When those birds hit the engines, did you know you were in big trouble?
Within seconds, yes.
Within seconds.
And I go into great detail in the book, telling things that have not been revealed before. I take the reader inside my head, what it felt like, what it sounded like, what it smelled like, what my thoughts were, how I made the choices I made. I had seconds to decide and minutes to execute a plan that would save the lives of 155 people, and Jeffrey Skiles and I worked seamlessly together as an effective team to do that. We had a lot of work to do and not much time in which to do it.
How much talk was there between the two of you?
Virtually none, interestingly enough. And what people also need to understand is that I had never met Jeff Skiles before Monday of that week, January 12th. And that's not uncommon in a large airline where you have thousands of pilots, you know, maybe 10,000 flight attendants. What that tells you about the airline industry is that we're all trained to such a high professional standard that we can be essentially interchangeable. And, of course, after September 11th in particular, security regulations would prevent you or one of your listeners from riding in my cockpit on the observer seat and watching us work together. But if you were ever able to do that, and I was flying with somebody like Jeff I hadn't met before, you couldn't tell that we hadn't worked together for years.
Did you see those birds hit?
I saw the birds about a second or a second and a half before we struck them. Now, we have to remember, we're traveling over 300 feet per second. So I saw them when they were more than a football field length away from us. But clearly, there was not enough time to react.
And they were heading right toward you, and you knew that this was going to happen a second or a second and a half before it did.
I didn't know that this outcome was going to happen. I didn't know it was going to damage both engines simultaneously. I saw the birds. I had enough time to say, birds, and then they hit us. But not enough time to make the airplane move. That was impossible, physical impossibility. So I didn't know they were going to damage both engines. I thought we might hit them. Sometimes you see the birds and you'll go over them because we were climbing at that point. But our flight path exactly intercepted theirs, and they hit the airplane from wingtip to wingtip, along the leading edges of the wings, the nose of the fuselage, just below the level of the windshields, many bird strikes. And then the investigators have determined that at least two of the birds entered the right engine and either one or two entered the left engine. And these were Canada geese. These were large migratory birds with wingspans up to 6 feet. That's almost 2 meters. And weighing from 8 to 16 pounds. And that's well beyond the certification standards of the size birds that these engines are required to be able to ingest.
So you get on the radio.
Well, not immediately. No, we had to keep our priorities straight, which was fly the airplane first. And so the first thing I did while Jeff was still flying the airplane was to take the two steps that, from my experience, I knew would do us the most good, and that was to turn on the engine ignition, the electrical igniters, so that if there was a chance of thrust being restored, it would happen automatically. And the next step I took was to start the auxiliary power unit, what we call the APU. That's a small auxiliary turbine that drives accessories, one of which is an electrical generator. And so we would have a redundant, a backup source of electrical power to keep all our instruments powered and make the flight control computers work normally. And after I did that, then I took control of the airplane, and we have even a protocol for that. And Jeff Skiles and I followed that protocol verbatim that day. I said, "My aircraft," and he responded immediately, "Your aircraft." And that was important because that let both of us know clearly which of us was going to control the airplane, and it automatically established the roles and responsibilities of each of us, me as a pilot flying and Jeff as a pilot monitoring. And it was then, after I lowered the nose to regain flying speed, at about 30 seconds after we hit the birds, that I made my first transmission to air traffic control. And I told Patrick Harden at New York Departure that we had hit birds, lost thrust in both engines, and were turning back towards LaGuardia. And I began to make a left turn.
And after that left turn, it became increasingly clear that you weren't going to make it back?
Yes. In order to regain flying speed, because you have to remember that we were in a climb configuration.
Right.
We were pointed uphill,
right,
with over 40,000 pounds of thrust from both engines pushing us up into the sky. And the nose was about 15 degrees above the horizon. Of course, when that thrust went away and the nose was still up, our speed began to decrease. And so I had to push the nose over fairly aggressively. And that made our rate of descent increase. And so now we're going down at over 1,000 feet per minute. And as I was making the left turn, I was looking out the windows to my left because all the landmarks I would need to see to choose a path were on my left side. And it was during that turn I would have to choose an option, and the option I chose would determine the ultimate heading I would fly.
I'm sitting here thinking of myself as a passenger in that plane, dropping 1,000 feet per second, and wondering
1,000 feet per minute.
1,000 feet per minute, and wondering what I am feeling physically.
Well, when we first lost the thrust on the engines, it felt like the bottom had fallen out. The forward momentum essentially
stopped.
Ceased. And I would describe it as the worst sinking feeling I'd ever felt. It was shocking. It was startling. You know, see, modern technology in engines is so reliable that I'd spent 42 years flying airplanes and had never experienced the actual failure of an engine ever in any airplane I'd ever flown.
Not even one engine.
Not even one. And here we were in a situation that was extraordinary. It was immediately obvious to me it was a dire situation, the most challenging situation ever faced in my life.
So I'm again trying to put myself in the passenger seat, wondering what, if anything, has been said to me.
Well, I did talk to the passengers after we'd taken care of the higher priority items, after we'd taken the steps to try to regenerate the airplane, after we'd maintained control of it, selected a proper flight path, chosen where we were going to end up, and advised air traffic control, and had then begun taking our step-by-step troubleshooting with Jeff using the emergency checklist to assist me. Then, about a minute before we touched down in the river, I made an announcement in the cabin. And I took some amount of time, probably 3 or 4 seconds, to choose my words very carefully. And I said, "This is the captain. Brace for impact." And what I wanted to do was to tell them it was important to brace because I did not know how successful I would be in trading our forward speed for a reduced rate of descent as we touched the water. I didn't know how hard the landing was going to be. And so I didn't want them fumbling for life vests. I wanted them in the brace position so we would avoid passenger injuries during the touchdown.
And your stewards, your flight stewards, were telling the passengers how to brace for impact?
That was the key to my using the word brace. My using the word brace was a trigger, a signal to the flight attendants in the cabin that they are to begin making their commands. And I heard, even through the hardened cockpit door, the two flight attendants in front, Donna Dent and Sheila Dale, immediately began shouting their commands in unison. They said, "Brace, brace, heads down, stay down," over and over again. So their training kicked in also, and they immediately knew what to do. And I talk about in the book how comforting and reassuring that was for me to hear them respond appropriately to my announcement in the cabin and to know that meant that we were on the same page, that they were doing their part. And if I could somehow find a way to deliver the aircraft to the surface intact, then they could get the passengers out and the rescue could begin.
Pretty scary stuff, bringing that plane in at a glide instead of nose down.
Well, it was more difficult than a normal landing because we had essentially no thrust on the engines, and so our rate of descent was steeper than normal. We were descending pretty rapidly, so I had to time exactly right the point at which I would begin pulling back on the control stick to raise the nose to slow down and cushion the touchdown. If I started it too high, I would run out of speed before I would touch the water, and we might drop in from too high an altitude. If I waited too late to begin it, then we wouldn't have reduced our rate of descent enough and would hit too hard.
I'm scared.
Well, it was my years of experience that convinced me that I could do this. And so the final portion of the flight, I looked only 2 places. And I described this in the text also. At a certain point, I began to look only directly ahead and only inside of my airspeed indication. Outside to judge our height and our rate of descent visually, inside at our speed. Outside, inside. My scan was outside, inside. And Jeff also had the experience, having 20,000 in flight hours, just like I do, having formerly been a captain at the airline before the staff reductions. He knew intuitively how important it was to assist me in this difficult task. And so at a point late in the flight at a low altitude, he stopped trying to restart the damaged engines and instead shifted to what then became a higher priority, calling out to my attention our airspeed and our height above the surface. You're now 250 feet, 150 knots, things like that, and that helped me greatly.
You had faith in yourself that you could do it.
And in my crew, and we never lost that faith. I think what helped us keep faith was we always had a plan. We knew that we could solve the next problem.
One problem at a time.
Exactly.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Then, once you made that successful glide onto the water, your next concern would be for the passengers, how to get them out on the wings safely. How was that accomplished?
Well, I opened the cockpit door and I shouted, "Evacuate." And that was, again, a signal that sent the flight attendants into their evacuation duties. The doors and exits were opened, the slide rafts were deployed, and they began saying, "Come this way." And I assisted in that. And within a short period, everyone was off the airplane, except for me, some flight attendants, the first officer, and a couple of male passengers who were gathering up blankets, coats, and jackets to hand outside to those on the wings and in the rafts.
So everybody cooperated.
Absolutely. And I think the passengers behaved so admirably for two reasons. First, it was a very seasoned group of mostly business travelers who obviously knew what to do and were very professional about it. And the second thing that happened is we had a very experienced and well-trained crew of flight attendants, Donna Dent, Sheila Dale, and Doreen Welsh, who by exhibiting a professional, calm demeanor got the passengers to respond in kind. And it was a rushed exit, but it was not pushing and shoving or screaming. It was orderly.
Isn't that good to know?
And it really helped. To prevent injuries during an evacuation is very important. And so we were very fortunate to have only some injuries and none of them life-threatening.
How quickly did help arrive?
Very quickly, because of where we landed in the river. And I knew this from experience because I'd been to Manhattan many times and I'd actually visited the USS Intrepid Museum there in the river before. I knew from experience that there were a lot of ferry terminals nearby. Because of where we landed, as soon as we stopped, within 3 minutes 55 seconds, the first ferry arrived.
You were timing.
Well, I watched the security tape afterward and figured out the timeline.
Right.
The Con Ed plant had a security camera that they were able to train on us as we landed and drifted further south with the current. And so there was a pretty good timeline about the happenings of the... You can see the doors open, the slides deploy. You can see the first boats arrive.
Mm.
And so by the time I left the airplane, there were several boats around us and the rescue had already begun.
Isn't that wonderful? Then... almost immediately, people began referring to you as a hero. How did you feel about that word?
Well, that word wasn't used right away, but shortly after the last three of us left the airplane, and the last three in order were the A flight attendant, Donna Dent, then First Officer Jeff Skiles, and then me, we all ended up in the left front raft together. We hadn't been in the raft very long when a male passenger who had been in first class turned to me and said, "Thank you." And I said, "You're welcome." And then Jeff and I had a brief conversation about the fact that we'd successfully made an emergency water landing, and not many people had done that. And he said, "You pulled it off." But I couldn't celebrate yet. We had solved the biggest problem of the day, but we hadn't solved all the problems. We had to get the people out of the river. And so I couldn't rest until everybody was out and everyone was accounted for. And it would actually be about another 4 hours until I got the official word that all 155 were safe.
Boy, that's a long time to wait for that word.
It was a very long time.
You must have been concerned, very concerned.
That's putting it mildly. Yeah. I couldn't rest until I knew that everyone was accounted for, and we didn't know that for hours, not officially. I knew everyone was off the airplane, but because people were taken to both sides of the river and to different hospitals and different locations, it took some time to get an accurate tally.
And then they took you where?
Well, we ended up landing on the west side of Manhattan at Pier 79, and as soon as I came ashore, the first person I saw was another fellow U.S. Airways pilot who lives in Manhattan who had heard about this, put on his uniform, got his ID, and came down to find us and assist us. His name is Captain Dan Barrett, and we immediately began making phone notifications to do all the authorities.
Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, the book is titled Highest Duty.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose Subsidy Scope project provides information about federal subsidies across industries at pewtrusts.org. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Please, 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 please.
King Records recorded James Brown and a mix of country, blues, and rhythm and blues. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the author of a book about King and from Bootsy Collins, who was a studio musician there, and Seymour Stein, the founder of Sire Records, who learned the music business at King. Join us.
I love you so.
Welcome back. I think people all over the world knew shortly after it happened that you, Captain Sully, landed that plane successfully in the Hudson River and that everyone got out safely and back to shore safely. We're going to open the phones now. Our first caller is in Rasht, Iran. Good morning, Nima. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane and Captain. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was following the news, and I'm a private pilot in Iran, and I was shocked and at the same time fascinated. But what a great job you did, Captain. But as a pilot, I have been simulating those critical moments in the cockpit, especially after 9/11. And with such a great talent you've got, my question to you is, what would you have done if those terrorists had entered your cockpit?
Well, we have the advantage of hindsight. Prior to September 11th, and I actually addressed this in the book a little bit, we were preparing for a Cuban-style hijacking and not using the airplanes essentially as kamikaze weapons. The cockpit doors have been strengthened. We have totally different procedures now that require us to do different things. And we, armed with the knowledge of what could be done, we have adjusted to take care of the possibility that might happen again and prevent it. It's unknowable. I don't know how I would have reacted at that time. They obviously found a way to force themselves into the cockpit to murder the pilots and to take over. But the important thing is that now we know that was a possibility and we have measures in place to prevent that from ever happening again.
Nima, as a pilot yourself, what would you have done?
It's a very difficult question, so I just try to ask this question from my teacher, the Captain Chelsea, but I think that was a very disrespectful moment for all pilots around the world, apart from those people who died in the event. But the fact that pilots in 9/11 succumbed the cockpit to those terrorists, it was a very disrespectful moment.
That's an interesting word.
Yes. I think had I been in that situation, I would have used every method, every means at my disposal to fight to the death. Have one pilot fly the airplane and the other fight them off, or perhaps put the autopilot on and have both pilots attempt to fight if they had breached the cockpit. But aside from that, without the knowledge of that possibility beforehand, it would have been very difficult.
Nima, thank you for your call. Here's an email from Lucy, who's in Dayton, Ohio, who says, I'm a glider pilot, and my first thought when I saw a video of the landing was, I wonder if he's a glider pilot. Please comment on the role of your glider experience in helping you make a successful landing on the Hudson.
Well, that's a good question, too. Well, if I hadn't been a glider pilot before January, I certainly am one now. But I flew gliders as a glider instructor at the Air Force Academy in Colorado and at my graduate school in Purdue, Indiana, for several years, but it's been a long time ago. I think what helped me more, what assisted me more since then, is just paying attention on reflight and managing the speed and altitude energy of the airplane carefully on many flights.
Here's a call I think you'll particularly appreciate. It's from Megan in Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm glad I had a little time to calm down. I was so excited to get in.
Hi, Megan.
Hi. Well, first off, if you'll permit me to say quickly that I hope that this experience as a whole will give the public a greater appreciation for what flight attendants bring, because the expertise and the training that they have is something that so rarely has to be used that I think people really don't appreciate what they're capable of doing when it's necessary.
I think you're right.
I think that's a great point, and I think that this serves as a reminder to all of us what really is at stake, that it's through the great care and skill of hundreds of thousands of aviation workers throughout the country that our aviation system is as safe as it is. And you're right that the flight attendants are not there just to serve Cokes and peanuts. They're really there as safety professionals, and they exercise great care every day to be able to take care of our passengers.
Megan, I gather your mother was on that plane.
Yes, Diane, she was. And because thanks to Captain Sullenberger and the crew, and I'm trying not to cry, that tomorrow we get to celebrate her 65th birthday.
Oh, wonderful.
Instead of looking back at what we lost, we get to look forward to years to come.
I think we all feel like we got second chances. Please wish her a happy birthday from me.
Happy birthday from me as well. Thanks for calling. Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Alvin.
Good morning. I get a little bit choked up every time I hear the story or see the picture, so you have to bear with me a little bit. But I really appreciate the courage and steadiness that you demonstrated with your crew and with your passengers in the flight. And I'm probably a little bit emotional about this because my father flew 59 missions in Europe during World War II.
Wow.
And he was under constant fire. He flew in the 8th Air Force in 1943 in B-17s and was on both of the Schweinfurt raids. But I have a question. I just wanted to make that comment. If fate had been a little bit different and you had to land upstream in the aircraft, would do you think there would have been a different outcome? Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
The wind was light out of the north that day, but the current was pretty strong to the south. I'd say 3 or 4 knots. But I don't think it would have made much difference if we'd landed north or south that day. But I honor your father's service. He must have been based in England.
Yes, he was in Polbrook, England, and between May and October of 43.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I was at Lakenheath on the F-4 in the 70s.
Well, congratulations, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Here's an email from Darren in Waldorf, Maryland. Could the captain explain the comment of not looking or talking to the co-pilot during the event? I had heard this recently and found it interesting, but only caught part of the story.
Well, that was actually a good thing that we didn't have to, because it would simply have wasted precious time that we didn't have a long conversation. Because Jeff and I had a common understanding of the problems that we faced, because we had lots of experience, we didn't need to talk about it at great length. And Jeff, by not objecting, was agreeing to the course of actions that I was proposing. And he observed what I was doing. He heard my conversations with air traffic control and my statements about where I was progressing to. I could see that he was getting out the quick reference handbook, and he had begun using it very quickly after I'd asked for it. So we began doing our parts already without having specifically asked for them. And as to not looking at each other, my focus had to be outside. Again, I had to see the major landmarks, choose whether I was going to attempt a return to LaGuardia or try to reach Teterboro or land in the Hudson. And it wouldn't have been helpful or appropriate for me to be inside looking at what Jeff was doing that much.
You know, it's interesting to me that the day before your flight, you were contemplating your enforced retirement at age 65 and how you were going to reorganize your life. Tell us about your thinking there.
Well, like many Americans going through difficult times financially now in the last couple of years because of the worldwide financial meltdown, airline employees have been going through similar things, but for a lot longer. Certainly for the last 8 years since the September 2001 terror attacks and airline bankruptcies and wage losses, termination of pension plans. And so 2 years ago, the retirement age for pilots was raised from 60 to 65, which gives many of us more time to try to make up some of what we lost. But I was well in my 50s when all these changes took place, when I lost 40% of my pay and my pension plan was terminated at my airline. And so I had several plans going forward. One was to use my long experience as a safety professional, as an accident investigator, to be a consultant after I left the airline. And that's something I plan to do still, in addition to flying.
So where are you now in terms of thinking about how the airlines are dealing with experienced pilots like yourself with these enforced retirement, with the loss of pension, with somehow not valuing the experience that you've brought to your work sufficiently?
Well, you know, experience matters. That's one of the things I talk about. Fundamental, well-learned skills matter. In-depth knowledge matters. Having the judgment that comes from long experience is a key to being a successful airline pilot. If our society does not choose to value this profession sufficiently, then I wonder going forward if we would be able to continue to attract the best and brightest, you know, the people with experience. this House bill that passed yesterday that will require increased experience and a greater licensing requirement for first officers in some of the smaller regional airplanes is a good step forward. We still have a long way to go in terms of the working conditions. The fatigue and rest issue is one that we've waited decades to resolve.
Tell me about that.
Well, the rest and fatigue mitigation rules that we now have were promulgated generations ago in a different time, in a different world, when many of the airlines didn't fly as many flights per day for a given crew that they do now, when it wasn't technologically possible to have the ultra-long flights we have now, some of them 15 or 16 hours in duration. So the fatigue issue has only gotten more acute, and yet we have outdated rules. One of the problems on domestic schedules is that we have short overnights, short rest periods of as little as 9 hours, 15 minutes from the time the flight arrives in the evening until you push back on your departure the next morning. And if anyone were to do the math and figure out the report time of being an hour plus in the morning before the first flight back out, the time necessary to deplane a full airplane, which might be 15 or 20 minutes, to walk out to the curb, wait for the hotel van, travel to the hotel, get something to eat, and try to get some sleep, you're looking at about 5 or 6 hours of sleep at the best.
What do you think should be the minimum?
I think everybody should get 8 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
I think that's the minimum. If we're and our days can be 15 hours long. Can you imagine trying to make a challenging instrument approach through the fog at night at the end of a 15-hour day when you got 5 hours of sleep the night before? It's just not a smart way to do business. And part of what being a professional is about is managing risk and trying to make the system better. And I think if we solve the fatigue issue, it would make the system work better.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And here's an email from Len, who says, in your opinion, how much did being a combat pilot add to your ability to act in an emergency?
Well, I'm not a combat pilot. I was a fighter pilot in the Air Force, but my service was right at the end of the Vietnam era.
I see.
And I did not complete my training until Saigon had fallen in 1975 and the war ended for us. So while I did lots of very challenging, demanding, you know, somewhat hazardous, low flying at high speeds and jet fighters, that helped me a lot. I didn't see combat.
Let's go to Mason, Ohio. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, Diane. Hi, Sully.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm glad to hear that you've come to peace and accepted your role as a hero. You're always going to be a hero to a lot of people. I want to talk today a little bit about the sterile cockpit rule, where in the cockpit there's not supposed to be an extraneous conversation below 10,000 feet. And I have a suggestion, see what you think about this idea, and maybe we can call this the Diane Rehm rule if it was adopted. How about below 10,000 feet, the cockpit mics are opened up to the passenger cabin, so the passengers have opportunity to hear everything that's going on. That would keep the pilots and co-pilots on task at all times.
Well, I think with every rule, we have to look at possible unintended consequences. And I think for a variety of reasons that this issue might be problematic. First, I don't think that it would be appropriate to open it up to the cabin. You have to remember why we have cockpit voice recorders. They're there for only one reason, and they're to assist the investigators after the fact in finding out what happened when there's an aircraft accident, especially when the crew does not survive. That's the only reason that they're there. And to breach that covenant that we have with the industry would be, I think, a major mistake. I think there are much better ways to do that. And even if we were able to get around that issue, I think the unintended consequence of that would be to inhibit the normal give and take, the normal vocalizations of one being alert, of certain realizations, of certain awareness. That's just part of a normal working relationship. I think it'd be a mistake. It wouldn't work in the real world.
One last question. How has this whole event affected your life with your family?
You know, at first it was just disruptive and overwhelming. But with time, we have realized what the people who have paid attention to this story have given us. And in their thanks to us, they've given us an amazing opportunity to have a bigger voice and to make a difference.
And how can you make a difference?
I'm trying to do what Jeffrey Skiles and I determined that we should do within days of landing in the Hudson. And that was, we felt an intense obligation to do as much good as we could in every way we could for as long as we could to educate the public about the needs of aviation safety.
Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, his new book is titled Highest Duty. Thank you so much for everything you've done. Congratulations.
Thank you, Diane. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.